There you go. We are live.
We are
Everyone,
live.
welcome to Bad Internet Friends, episode 18, the very special episode with Scott Wainwright of Brutality.
Hey.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I'm really excited.
And a few other things, but we'll get through all of that. Do you want to give us like the 10-second introduction to who you are?
I'm Scott Wainwright. I published Brutality Skirmish War Game and four supplements that go with that. It's model agnostic skirmish game, but there's also model rules adaptations such as Mech and Kaiju is Brutal Epic. Space Battles and Ground Battles is Brutal Space. I just released Mass Brutality this November, which is basically Warhammer but Brutality rules. And I'm almost finished with a massively open world adventure game. It's kind of like a solo MMO, but in a book. So that's what I'm doing.
Pretty phenomenal.
Thank you. So I also do YouTube too. I also have a Let's Talk Tabletop YouTube channel. So gotta plug
And I
that.
know I found it and I subscribed to it. Now I can't
Oh.
figure out where it is again. Somebody
It's a
somewhere.
thought that
So I meant to
counts.
catch up on your content before the show, but
Yeah,
unfortunately, it
yeah.
escaped me.
Well, you're just
That's
ahead
all.
of me because I was just looking on the looking at the free rules and stuff.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, what do you want to talk about?
You're just fresh off the game scene, right? You just came back from a game.
Yeah, from the a local gaming store. We every Wednesday night we have our game club. So yeah, it's predominantly Warhammer, but it's other things. You know, Star Wars Legion and the Brutality games, etc. So it's a mix of things.
So tell us a little bit about that, because that's the thing. We've had a guy on before we talked about. He runs a gaming club up in Norway. So that would be nice. Like, what? How many people do you guys usually get? Is like four dudes in a corner? Is like a whole bunch of dudes? Or what's the
Well, so we've accomplished something pretty big is we live in a black hole for gaming. There is nothing near us within an hour of any population center or anything. And we've had the club. I've ran the club for 15, 14 years, something like that. And we have any given Wednesday, we have on average, I'll say 8 people. But we can have up to 15 people. We probably have a roster of like 20, 25, but you know how that goes where people come like, you know, once every 3 months. Some of those people do. And but being that we live in an absolute black hole in a very rural area, like I'm super happy we've gotten what we've got. So
That very well main income is like every gamer in that area, depending.
yes. Yep. Actually, I drive a half hour to go there. I've got other people that drive 40 minutes to go there, and I've got some people that drive an hour to get there. So it's crazy.
Yeah, you got to be committed then, like an hour back and forth to get your game
Yeah.
on. That's and where in the world are you, just in general?
Maryland, US. So the East
Oh,
Coast.
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Your accent doesn't sound super Maryland.
I don't really know that. I mean, there's Baltimore has a distinct accent, but I don't know if Maryland does. Yeah, we're not quite south enough to be southern, and we're not quite north enough to be northern, so we're kind of in the middle there.
That makes sense.
Ivan, you also live in a black hole of gaming, right?
I live in a black hole of literally everything because I live in rural Indiana. We got nothing here except corn. So if you want
Wow.
anything, you got to go over to Lafayette, which is 45 minutes. So, luckily, I have an 18-year-old kid and a brother-in-law who's interested in gaming, so and a friend
Oh.
who's in driving range. So there's it's definitely a case of like having to make some gaming out of a situation that doesn't otherwise happen because nobody here does anything other than like drink.
drink and farm, huh?
probably at the same time. Sometimes it looks a little shaky out there. So
Perfect.
tell us a little bit, because brutality is kind of a whole like phenomenon. It's a whole bunch of things that are connected to each other. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's kind of the elevator pitch for brutality, other than the absolutely bitching cover art, I'm just gonna say.
Oh, thank you. I didn't make it, but yes, I appreciate it. I love it. That's oh gosh, I'm on the spot now and I can't remember his name.
I was gonna maybe even shout out the guy.
It's Wild Weasel is his handle, but I if you asked me off camera, I probably would have remembered, but I can't. It, again, it was published 5 years ago, so And I haven't worked much with him since, because I used a good portion of his illustration library for that book. So he only had so much. But man, I'm feeling really bad. I can't remember his name. But the elevator pitch for Brutality is that it is model agnostic and the setting supports that. So I can have Power Rangers, you can have Space Marines, whatever. Narratively, the setting supports anything you want. And you stat them out the way that you see fit. So if your guy, you know, has a big shield and armor, you might make him a breacher upgrade or whatever. And essentially, it's broken down into four different. They're called classes, but they're essentially like I'm trying to think of what the word would be. You know, like channels. Like one is melee, one is fast, one is support and ranged.
Oh, yeah.
And archetypes is what I'm trying to think of. Archetypes.
Yeah.
And then each one of those classes, we are the core book has 7, and I think we're up to 9 upgrades for each one. And that specializes them more into, like, your basic ranged is 2 shots, whatever, like a rifle, bow and arrow, whatever. But if you upgrade them to an ordnance, then their shots explode, that sort of thing. So it uses archetypes. So it makes it versatile because you can make whatever you want. Arguably, if my basic ranged has a rifle and your basic ranged has a bow and arrow, they're more or less the same thing. I mean, for game purposes, at least, you know.
Mm.
Now, of course, you get abilities and things like that. You can tweak it and make it a little more like I might use the crushing wound chart roll if I'm using a shotgun, and you might be using piercing if you're using an arrow. So we even have 3 different damage charts that do different types of damage, crushing, burning, and piercing, depending on if you have a hammer, a sword, a torch, whatever. And also a big thing about this is not only is it model agnostic, because there's a million games out there that are, but it supports all of the different genres, and your stats and effects change during the game is a big deal. So every time you take a damage, if it's an armed attack, you take a wound chart roll as well. So you might get 20% less to hit in melee, or it might confuse you and you start wandering around or whatever. Most games, once you have your stat line, you can basically just memorize it. And then even if you're playing a campaign and they're like, oh, you took an injury, well, that's after the game, you know, in between games. But this is like real time being injured, being affected, and it makes for a pretty chaotic game. But that seems to be what people like about it. So,
yeah. Awesome. So what was the what was like the first thing that was, you know, like the first thing that went on your notebook or the first thing you wrote, or like, was there a mechanic? Was there a specific concept? Like, what was the absolute first thing that you wrote down or created when you sat down to make it?
Well, I think you'd have to go with the game system, what kind of dice size you're using. And mine uses D10s. And you really don't need more than 3 D10s for any action. But the D10s I like a lot better than D6s, because I don't need to explain it to you, but I'll say it anyway. Just the versatility. You can have better modifiers. You have a bigger range of, you know, numbers, probability, and all of that. So yeah. I think the very go ahead.
They map easily to... Oh, sorry. I was just going to say they map very easily to percentiles, obviously.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, every point is 10%. That's so easy to... Yeah. Versus a D6 is, what, 18% or whatever per pip. So, yeah. So that was the very first thing. But the whole impetus for Brutality originally was that I had kickstarted so many different games, miniatures games, and in most cases, none of my group members played them, or maybe one guy played it. And I had like 6 different games with miniatures. Nobody would play with me. And I didn't want to throw them away, but I also wanted to use them because I spent money on them. So then I end up saying, I want a game where I can use any genre of anything. And actually, I've got a massive... if you can see that, all of these glass cases of warbands of superheroes, Power Rangers, Ninja Turtles, Thundercats, literally everything.
It's so massive.
Yeah.
It's probably 60 warbands. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Neat.
So.
Yep.
So, in this case, you had a need, personally, that wasn't really being satisfied. So you set out creating something that would kind of fill that. But you... Because you said an interesting point, you kind of alluded to it, that there's a lot of miniatures agnostic games, but they all tend to have like a more set vibe. Like there's a lot of agnostic games which are mostly like military sci-fi, or agnostic games, but they're mostly like space fantasy or whatever. Like, that's so how do you go about getting kind of a wider, you know, if I want to bring my Warhammer orcs and you want to use, you know, some old World War One British infantry, like how do you get the rules and everything to kind of, you know, how do you pull out to avoid like nailing down the vibe and saying, okay, you can do anything you want as long as it's gritty military sci-fi. You know what I mean?
Well, again, the archetype system that I made, whereas, you know, a blunderbuss is similar to a shotgun, is similar to some magmamancer blasting you with lava. You know, it's similar enough. And then I've got multiple layers of customization where you can really make it your own. So you and I could bring two warbands of all the same upgrades, but our faction traits different. We could have taken a legendary trait. All of our stats are different. Our model ability is different. There's a wide range of variations. So at first it might sound samey, like, oh, my shotgun and your plasmancer have the same, but no, you can really change. And then we can even change different wound chart roll. We can even choose different damage chart rolls when we do our damage. So if you want to do burning because you're a magmancer, I want to do crushing because of a shotgun or whatever. Everybody loves to, I guess what you're really asking is, everybody loves to, when they're designing a game, they like to tell you what something is, but I actually change that around and I tell you what something does. So it's all about what your miniature does, not what it is. And that way it broadens it to a wider spectrum of things. So,
yeah. I think the super nerds might call that like designing for effect or something. I'm not a terminology guy, but that sounds reasonably.
That sounds nice. Yeah.
But it's basically focusing on, I had a similar realization when I did my Squad Hammer rules, which was that, for that game, because it's based on units rather than individual figures, that the difference between morale damage and physical damage could essentially be nothing. A unit that has been wiped out might be all dead, but in good morale, or they might have broken, but none of them died. So once you sort of have that realization, suppressing fire and being chopped up with a sword all amounts to the unit taking damage that eventually, you know, so it's turning it around. I like that turn of phrase, turning it around and essentially looking at it from like the opposite end. Like we start with the end point of what happens mechanically, and then whether that's an orc archer or like a space marine with a railgun, that maybe matters more for how you, what options you picked, or, you know.
And with my other rules adaptations, Brutal Epic, Brutal Space, and Mass Brutality, you know how like Age of Sigmar and 40K are maybe 80% the same rules. They're similar, but they're different. These games are often 90% the same rules, but they're applied so much differently. So like in Brutality, a small little human guy has 3 hit points, right? Just your basic unit. Well, in Brutal Space, they're called modules, but it's essentially you pay for multiple people and smash them together into one ship is essentially what you do.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, 4 what would be people in Brutality can be smashed together for a ship that's 12 hit points, because it'd be 3-3-3-3, that sort of thing. My mech and kaiju game is similar. They all have their own different tweaks and restrictions. Like, obviously, the ships have a turning arc and different things to make it more of a ship battle. But, yeah, so they're...
What is something, because when you're translating a game system into a diff to tackle something that it didn't start out doing, because it sounds like you started with a skirmish game and then moved in different directions with it. What are some challenges or some unexpected things you ran into that you realized, okay, this part does have to be 10% different, because otherwise it's not going to work for, you know?
I'm not sure how to answer that. So yeah, just through the discovery process, I mean, I was actually really surprised that everybody claims, and I also like to hear that Brutality is very balanced. And yes, it's chaotic and all of that, but at the end of the day, most of our games are like 1 or 2 points away from each other. Like, they're not something really has to go badly for it to be a blowout. You know, like as in Warhammer, you could play a Warhammer game and lose by 40 points or something crazy, right? So even my mass brutality game, which is basically brutality on steroids, and instead of, you know, if brutality is 7 points, mass brutality goes up to 50 points, and it's usually 3 people per module, not one person with 3 hit points. So the scale is different, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you have a full army of essentially a 2,000 point Warhammer army on the board, and all the time we end up tying. And I'm talking like 41 to 41 or very close to tying, you know, like, so yeah. I was really, I realized that I actually did this backwards and I did it the proper way and I didn't know I was doing it. So like Warhammer, and the reason why I keep bringing it up is it's the elephant in the room, and also I'm really well-versed in it. Warhammer is a large scale, and then they try to shrink it down to do like Necromunda or Mordheim or whatever those things are. The real small scale. And a lot of the core rules don't translate because you started big and that doesn't always translate to small. But then, what's it say? Connection lost. Oops.
Oh, you're back, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear us?
Oh, am I back now?
I think so.
I lost the connection.
Can you hear me, Dave?
I can hear you. Yeah. But Scott is definitely frozen in...
Can you hear me?
Oh, he's back. In vocals, at least.
Can you hear us?
I'm waiting for it to come back.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I don't think you can hear us.
Hello? am I back now?
You haven't actually left. He's in another dimension.
I don't think he was hearing us. Right. No, well, it wouldn't be a Biff cast without a little bit of technical trouble.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just pop in and say, hey, Dwayne, and hey, Mini Warmut. Good to see you guys. We're have a little bit of audio troubles with Scott, but we're working on it.
Oh,
he's back.
Better.
Okay, am I good now?
So far, so good. Yeah.
Am I good now?
I don't think he can hear us.
Hello? Hello?
It's coming through only one way.
Yeah.
Hey. Can you hear me now?
Ooh. Can you hear us?
Am I back? Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, hey, perfect. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're there? You're looking good?
Okay.
All right.
We can hear you. Okay, well, I guess I'll keep this door open, I guess.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. That's anyway.
The vital part.
Yeah.
I don't know. I opened the door and then it worked. So,
the signal the right way and then you're good.
Yeah.
I apologize for that. So, I forgot what I was talking. Oh, so I accidentally stumbled upon this.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you get all of the small parts balanced on a super small scale, like a skirmish game, it happens to be that it expands really, really well to a larger scale. Because if it was already pretty darn balanced, it's generally balanced with minor tweaks on a bigger scale. So I don't know how much you heard of what I was saying, but even in our big scale mass brutality, and I'm not just trying to like, you know, blow smoke or brag or whatever, but I'm being honest.
It's all good.
That you a
can,
lot of our...
You can polish your halo a little.
Yeah, definitely. You got to brag a bit.
Well, a lot of our games end up either tying or being within 5 points of each other. I mean, we might be 41 to 43 or something. Yeah. And you're talking about a table full of miniatures. And it just, the dice screw you enough that it's hard to be super, super edgy about it. You know, super, super like try hard. And, so it's nice. It actually ends up, there's enough, like, I have a lot of 10% this, 10% that, like, chances of failure or critical fail or whatever.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is if you learn any one of my games, you can, like, very easily go over to literally any of my other games because it's, like, 90% the same core rules. So, that was my spiel.
All right, well, that's a pretty good spiel. So, yeah, it's so interesting because in a way, like game design is, you know, anyone who's played games long enough and has played a couple of different things, realize there's a finite number of problems to solve, and then there's a near infinite number of ways to solve those problems.
Absolutely.
So it's always interesting to see, like, how many ways can you recombine the same pieces and still get new and interesting things when the different pieces work together in a certain way, which I think is really fascinating. So you mentioned that this kind of came out of, like, you had a specific need. You had a bunch of different miniatures that you weren't really able to use because they came from different games or Kickstarters or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How much, when you create things, do you take into account the expected audience for the game other than yourself? Like, there's, you know, you see it a lot when, like, book writers get interviewed. They'll talk about, like, whether they're writing for themselves or they're writing for the audience or sort of balancing that. How much do you sort of keep that in mind, whether it's, like, this has to be, you know, commercially viable to some level, or this has to be, you know, maybe this is something that doesn't really exist yet, so maybe it would do really well. Or this is my audience, and I don't think they would be into this super detailed system, so maybe we cut that because that's just not their vibe. Like, how much does that factor into your decisions?
It's going to sound real selfish, but I just make the game I want to play. So, mm-hmm. And it happens to be that some other people also want to play it, which is great. Brutality, if you're playing Brutality and you know the rules, you can play in a half hour. Like me and my buddy James, we know the rules so well that we easily finish a whole game in 30 minutes. When we go to the game club and play, we can play literally three games, no problem, three different opponents, I'll bring several war bands, and we can get it done. So my time is really important to me, and that's why a short game is important to me, small amount of figures. So I just made the game that I wanted to play. And unfortunately, it's kind of like a disease because Brutality has, like, taken over my entire life. And I've fallen more and more out of Warhammer because it spoils me. And especially now that I have mass Brutality, I don't even want to play Warhammer because, and this isn't like a sales pitch, it's legitimate. And it makes me sad because I have 20 Warhammer armies. And now I only want to play Mass Brutality with them because I'm not beholden to whatever they wanted to sell this quarter or whatever codex sucked or was good or whatever. My flayed ones, I had 40 flayed ones back in 5th edition when they sucked and in 6th and 7th when they sucked. So I love flayed ones. The cool thing now is they don't have to suck. I can stat them out the way I want and then they don't have to suck, right?
Yeah.
So... it's spoiled me for creative choice. You know, I can just make whatever I want now. And I feel a little bad because more and more of my gaming group is just going over to Brutality more and more. And it's like, now it's probably half of my gaming group plays Brutality most weeks. And I feel bad because it's supposed to be a Warhammer group. You know, I'm not trying to take it over. But it sucks because I used to love Warhammer so much, but GW makes me mad a lot. Like, they make everybody mad. So, but I have
don't hate the player, hate the game. Like,
I know, right? Well, that's the thing. Like, anyone who's been a Warhammer fan for long enough has gone through, you know, you'll have periods where you're really in love with it. You'll have periods where it's like the bitter ex, you know, just... That's just the life cycle of it. My time was so long ago that now it's like fussy nostalgia instead, which is fine. Like, I made my peace with that. Like, it doesn't have to be. At some point, you kind of get to a point where, like, okay, current Warhammer is not really for me, but then it wasn't meant to be, and it doesn't have to be. Like, you just kind of make peace with it. Did you have questions you wanted to throw in before I ramble on, Dave?
I don't have questions, but I do have that one little game I want to challenge you both.
Oh,
if you're feeling up for it now, before we launch into the next rant, and before we do that, Dwayne Gardner would like to thank Scott for an awesome game, which he said on the Facebook group, and thanks to Ivan and I for an awesome podcast. Thank you, Dwayne.
Thank you very much.
He was very excited for last week's episode, and then it didn't quite work out, so I was able to pop in this week. It was very nice.
But now that you got to wait for it a little bit, that probably made it even better.
Yeah, that's right. He's working right now, and it's pushing him through, I think, doing what he's doing.
So we'll keep going until your shift is over.
Ooh, that's a long haul. Okay, so...
My phone battery won't last that long.
No.
You better be fast, man.
The setup for the game is that you are both game designers.
This is...
But I don't think you can easily design this kind of game because it's based on the D4.
Okay.
It's not just any kind of game. It is, I'm going to pull up the image now, the ultimate Street Fighter fighting game.
Okay.
Using only D4s to resolve combat. Can it be done?
Well.
And I apologize for the use of AI art right off the
bat.
I wanted my daughter to recreate it, but she's busy having fun summer things.
Ah, that's fair. Can't argue with that. It definitely can be done. Now I'm trying to think. I feel like somebody could do something where you have like a pool of D4s and you roll and the fours explode and you're trying to get over a target number or something. I feel like there's something there. You got to have like different moves, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the essence of the fighting game. There's jumping, there's punching, there's kicking, there's special moves, blocking.
Well, what do you say, Scott? Are the fighters actually moving around, or are you just sort of picking options, like kind of like an RPG combat? We just kind of like take turns kicking each other on the shins.
Well, like instead of a target number, I like to have, like, just in your picture, you've got two different colors, right? And you usually go by whatever the top number is, right? When you roll it in D&D or whatever. But I'm actually interested in what the bottom corner numbers are for it. So if they were whatever corner of the dice is facing the other one, it might have different powers or actions for each number it rolls. And of course, you'd pick the two different, you'd pick different types of dice where one threes might be aggressive or whatever. And you wouldn't have control of that per se, but that would be neat to watch the two fight. You know?
That makes it interesting. Especially if you then have tag team where you're 2v2, because then it becomes, you know, this one is a two facing your guy, but it's a three facing that guy, depending on the character. You could have it where your moves require a certain number. So to do the fireball, I need a pair of twos pointing, you know, your direction. But if I have a pair of threes instead, it's a different kind of attack. Maybe I move forward and strike or something. So yeah, that's kind of tactile. The downside is that you will have like waves of dice, like washing away characters. So you have to have some minute. You can't bring those like fucking metal dice sets that one nerd always shows up with. You gotta bring the cheap chess like stuff, otherwise you're gonna endanger the miniatures.
I was just thinking of the dice as the fighters and the corners that face the other fighter. You'd have to roll them in something that's very tight, like a cup or a bowl. But your addition of a second one, you know, some fighting games are 2v2, and if you rolled two, then you're right. One corner could be facing, you know, one opponent facing the other or whatever, how they scatter. So you could even have two dice team up on one or whatever would be interesting.
I think the answer, Dave, is that it could definitely be done. Now somebody needs to be the first to rush this to Wargame.
That's right. Awesome. D4 Die Fighter.
Yeah, yep. Die Fighter sounds pretty good.
Die Fighter? Oh, yeah, yeah.
That sounds very, like, translated Japanese manga.
Yeah.
Die Fighter 4.
Yeah.
What were the first fighters
of the universe of love?
Ooh. True booty.
Fighting games always have, like, monumental amounts of backstory that nobody who plays the game will ever know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being vaguely interested in whatever Mortal Kombat came out like 3 games ago and going and looking up, and I was like, holy shit, these guys have like life histories. I'm not reading all this shit. Like, they're just punching each other in the face.
Yeah, that's fine.
Like, that is a lot. Like, maybe that is one of those things you realize, like, there are types of nerd that you don't even realize exist out there. There's somebody out there is just like an expert in like Sub-Zero's like life history or something.
Well, you know what? You say that. I met at an event one time. I met some guy that was super, super nice, but he went on and on and cornered me telling me every single type of graboid from the Tremors movies. And he knew all of it. And I don't know if there's like books or something, but he could just ramble off graboids. Yep.
You got to have your thing. For some of us, it's, you know, cars. For some of us, it's Scottish 19th century literature. And for that dude, it's Tremors. You got to respect that. But preferably at a distance.
Yeah.
So I prepared a couple of slightly sillier questions to put you on the spot a little bit.
Sure.
So the first one I called... Oh, I thought I'd given these like funny titles, but apparently I didn't. So they're just...
Oh.
It is the game, an existing game that you wish you had gotten the idea for and written. So it could be absolutely anything. It could even be a game that you've just seen but haven't actually played yet. But the idea of it or whatever, like...
I mean, to be honest with you, I really do. I know it has its problems now, but Magic is such a great idea, in my opinion. At its core, I don't care for all of the SpongeBob and things they're putting in it now, but like at its core, it's such a good game. Like, and it's been so, they've slapped on and patched on so many things over the years, and by and large, I think they work generally. You know, adding new abilities and things like that. I mean, rarely do you see a game that's so versatile and simple at its core, but can also be hyper competitive and complex. It's a really good platform, I think.
You once ruled the realms with dice and a sword, painted goblins till tea, then your minis were stored. You grew up, got a job, bought a flat, wore a tie, swapped dragons for deadlines, your brushes went dry. Now the dishes are done and the kids are in bed. You climb to the attic to raise the undead. Crack open the paints that you swore you'd outgrown. The smell of acrylic, it feels like your home. There's grey in your beard, even more on your head, but you're splashing some colour on plastic and lead. So welcome back, General. What took you so long? Your hobby's still here. It's the place you belong. The Bedroom Battlefields Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Find it at bedroombattlefields.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, so, they also have the advantage because they have the, I forget what it's called, but like you play with like the last core set and the last two expansions or whatever. So like,
yeah,
even if you break the game, it's only broken for like a little while. It'll cycle through. So yeah, like Magic is an absolutely phenomenal piece of design work. It's one of those things that where the basic idea is like so simple, you know,
and then
it's just endless permutations of it. That's a really good one.
That would be my vote.
Yeah, that's a great pick. Then I realized the second question was basically the same one. It was a game you would like to give your own take on, but then you can pick a different one, I guess. Okay, no, we can swing it back then. I swear I am apparently just like bad at writing questions. This is why I'm not a journalist. If you were the one to create Magic, which basically also means like creating the collectible card game, really, what's a thing you would have done differently to how Magic did it? I don't know when you started playing Magic. I started 4th edition, which was close enough to the original era. But
I started in 97.
Okay.
Started in 97. And was Ice like Age? Ice Age, yeah. Ice Age, and I don't remember... I'm not good with all the, like...
Yeah, I think Garage was next. That was around the era where I played. So, okay, so we have the same, like, starting experience base. That's, like, in rock-throwing range of the original set.
Yeah.
So what is something you would have done differently?
Oh, man. I don't know. Because I really do think, and I'm not, like... I only play for fun with my family. I don't even go to the store and play because I don't keep up with all the new cards or anything. But I find it so simple yet so adaptable that I really have a hard time. You know, the one thing I would say is I know it makes a ton of money, but I'm really, really against this SpongeBob, Spider-Man stuff. Yeah. And I'm not trying to sound like a grognard or anything, but I really feel like, yes, that's short-term goals, you know, like money. But long-term, like you're killing all of your lore and your backstory for Magic. I just don't. I don't like it.
I wonder if it's one of those things, because I think there's one kind of Magic players who is specifically just in it for like the cards and the mechanics, and there's a separate group that is like really into.
There you go. I like, lost you for lore. A second.
Nope.
Oh, okay. I was just saying, I think there's like two different groups of Magic players, because there's some people who are really into like the vibe and the lore and stuff, and some sets are kind of for them. And then there's a different group who's just interested in like the mechanics of the cards, and they could just have pictures of like colored squares on them. It would make no difference to that group.
Yeah,
I remember the they did the I forget the name of it, but they did a block that was like gothic horror. So it had like dudes in tricorn hats and werewolves and stuff. It was so cool. It was just heavy on like the vibe. It was a whole set where everything just felt like really cohesive. It had this really strong atmosphere. Like, I have like a love-hate relationship with Magic, because like whenever I'm not playing Magic and haven't played in a while, I think about like, oh, that was so much fun, and then I play it again and I remember why I don't play it anymore. But that was like, because the thing I always enjoyed was like making often like jank like theme decks, so like I bring my elf, you bring your goblins kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
like things like that, that was really fun. The one thing I always wondered about is what Magic would have looked like if it didn't have land cards. You know, if it had been something like... Because every other card game seems to, like, reinvent that some way. Either you get resources automatically, or they're tied to an action, or, you know, everyone, like, whether it's because of copyright or just because everyone, like, got mad that one time they couldn't draw any islands or something.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, I made my own type of Magic with a bunch of intellectual property. I had like Scooby-Doo, Power Rangers, Britney Spears, like I had, you know, and the enchantments were like addicted to heroin and stuff. Like it was, you know, it was crazy. And but being a teenager.
Yeah.
And I printed them all out. I still have many of them actually from all those years ago in a drawer. And my friends and I love to play it. And one of the first things that we did was we got rid of mana altogether, and it was a D6 roll. But if you rolled a one, you got to re-roll it. So, and if you rolled another one, you're just screwed.
Yeah.
But potentially getting, you know, 2 to 6 mana on the first turn, everybody came out swinging pretty quick, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
you get some big creatures out.
Yeah, and then also getting your bigger creatures out, I made none of them higher than 6 mana. So it wasn't cheesable so much, because you weren't building. It reset every turn when you rolled the dice. So it actually became a probability thing where, can I put out this big monster? Well, I have an 18% chance of rolling a 6. So yeah, so I guess that would be one thing, but we liked it way better than actually messing with mana and all that.
Yeah. No, that sounds pretty interesting actually.
So Brutality kind of started as a Magic the Gathering game.
Sometimes I get like very unusual inspirations. Like the first game I published that like more than like my personal friends played, because you know your personal friends you can force into anything, and they are usually like too polite, or maybe not, it depends, but they might be too polite to tell you that it's garbage and you need to go make a better game, right? But the dice mechanic was actually inspired by like the White Wolf role-playing games. It had nothing to do with that stuff otherwise, but that's just where the mechanic came from. So sometimes, you know, stuff can come out of like unexpected origins.
Absolutely.
What is an idea? This was the third question, the one that got away. What is an idea that you have either worked on and put away, or you've thought about but you keep like putting it away? Like the grail that you want to do sometime, but the time hasn't been ready yet, or you know.
I keep a pretty extensive list of future projects that I want to do, and I keep like a roadmap. There's one new supplement for Brutality that I have not yet done, and I do keep pushing it off, not because I'm not excited for it, but it's called, tentatively it's called Catchimals, and essentially it's you can essentially introduce Pokemon into Brutality. And it's got some really neat, like they don't evolve, but they become enraged. So they get better and better, and things like that. And you do have a trainer, like a master that's a human, and he's like weak. And the animals often don't like follow what you want to do. You have to roll a behavior dice every turn. And on a 10, 5, or a 1, they do different things, which may not be what you want them to do. And and the trainer can control one per turn and all. It's really, really cool. We play tested it like a year and a half ago, and we loved it. I bought a bunch of like $1 Pokemon figurines, and we just had a blast with it. But the problem was, is that last year in the spring, I was going to start working on catchables, and then Games Workshop killed like three of my armies that I had fully painted and just pissed me off. So then my next thing was to make Mass Brutality. So the next 6 months was making Mass Brutality out of just sheer rage. Yeah. And so then I've been talking to Modiphius for like almost 2 years now about a project, you know. And then the next thing I had was this RPG I got really excited about, which Ketchumals was supposed to be last fall. And then it was supposed to be this spring, but now this RPG has pushed Ketchumals to probably the beginning of next year, because this is a huge undertaking, this whole RPG book is. So
yeah.
I'm so excited for it. And again, it slots right in there. You can have your Pokemon, I can have my orcs or whatever. But the play style is very different, but it's just really cool. And it's not for lack of enthusiasm.
All right. So it's the one that got away for a good reason, but it hasn't gotten that far away.
Rage.
Yeah. First or second quarter 2026. We'll get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless rage happens right, again.
Yeah.
You're on the record.
Yeah.
So fans will like click hang on to that too. If something happens, they're like, well, you said on the 17th of June.
Well, that is the truth. On our Facebook page, people keep reminding me every couple months, hey, when's Ketchumals coming out? And I'm like, oh, not yet, because it keeps getting pushed back. Yeah. So actually, Mass Brutality was on my docket to do, but in like 3 years, like it was so much on the back burner until they torched three of my armies and I was so mad. So that took over.
That was my intro to GW. Actually, I started by collecting an undead army in 5th edition, and that was just before 6th edition rolled out. So I had like a good like a year. I painted out my army. I built them. I loved them. I had a lot of fun. And then 6 came and just split it in half. I'm like, I don't have enough Tomb Kings. I don't have enough vampire counts. I don't have GW anymore. And that was it.
Wow. And you just washed your hands right there?
Yeah, basically. I'm like, oh, I'm just not going to play Hammer Fantasy Battle. I played 40K a little bit because my friends did, but yeah, just kind of never really got back in.
It's rough. Sometimes it can really take you out of it, especially if it's something you've been working on, you know? So, because when you build an army, you're putting so much like time and effort and energy into it. Like it's a major thing. So having it, you know, kind of messed with, it can really like take out your energy and your enthusiasm for it, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, once I got back into wargaming, I just immediately started looking at alternative rule sets. There was like cool ones back in the day. There was like the Mongoose Judge Dredd and things like that.
That was
great. Oh,
yeah.
I always feel now, sad because like that era of Mongoose was like so cool. They were just like doing all kinds of stuff, and some of it was a little jank, but that was just kind of the Mongoose thing. But they were just like they had the was it Babylon 5, the space game, and Starship Troopers and all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Starship Troopers was cool. I didn't know about the Babylon 5 game.
Yeah, it was, I think it called A Call to Arms. They had a pretty nice like figure range for it, too. They probably go for like $1 trillion on eBay now because out of print stuff. But yeah, it was
Starship
really
Troopers
neat.
Do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one I'm surprised nobody else has like picked up because that seems like such an obvious one. But it's so difficult now to do like a big figure range for a game. Unless you have, it's one of those things like you can be, it's a big market, but it's also a very small market, you know? Like there's not that many. It feels like there's many games coming out like basically every week, especially on Kickstarter. But the number of games that have like dedicated figure ranges, like what we used to, I feel like that's a little dicey. Maybe that's a topic for a different episode. But
Kickstarter is a huge topic.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh god.
Yeah.
We've got to kick that football around. But tell us a little bit actually. What's your sort of take on Kickstarter? What's like the ups and downs of Kickstarter for miniatures gamers?
I mean, so I think Kickstarter is like such a double-edged sword because it's fantastic to enable the little guy to fund all of their things, right? Which they never would normally have the capital for that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, now the floodgates are open and everybody has a game. And the problem with that is that just like what I ran into with kickstarting things is that if everybody backs different games, then no game succeeds. And unfortunately, like, Games Workshop always succeeded because it was like the only game in town, more or less, and then it just snowballed from there. Well, yeah. Nobody can ever catch up because there's so many games, nobody like focuses on one. So, and the Trench Crusade to me sounded like, you know, that might be like a contender for, you know, because everyone was so hyped about it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the hype seems like it's kind of died down, and I don't know. I don't really like the lore, and I just don't. The models look cool. Yeah. But
the models are really neat.
Yeah.
I wonder, one thing I wondered with that game was, because the community that kind of latched onto it was like the Inquisitor 28 types. And the good thing with those people are that they're really enthusiastic and really energetic. But the bad thing is they don't really play games very much. They mostly paint minis and like speculate on lore for like very, very long blog posts and stuff. So, which is fine. That's like a separate hobby almost, but it doesn't necessarily produce like people showing up to a store and playing a game. You know what I mean? Like you got to have people who are, it's like a lot of the like old hammer guys on the blogs. They don't really play games. They just like paint old Space Marines and talk about
absolutely
them and complain that things were better in second edition. Which I can appreciate. I think it was better in second edition, but that doesn't really like drive a movement. You know, you got to have people who are willing to like put up minis and roll some dice. Wonder sometimes I get a feeling with when I look at these, because there are almost like between like board games and minis games, that's almost like a Kickstarter on a daily basis. And a lot of them look really cool, but I also wonder like how many of them are really like, how much of it is just like shelf fodder? Like you buy it.
Yeah.
Like, I try not to, but I still have a couple of games that I bought, and like in hindsight, maybe I wouldn't have, because the odds of them ever like getting played was like not good. And a lot of, especially Kickstarters that are like super front loaded with like minis and stuff, it often feels like it's almost selling more on just like getting the stuff than necessarily like creating a, I don't even know what you call it, game system, game environment,
community, system. Like,
yeah, like that is actually like can perpetuate itself and can actually like become a thing, you know.
Well, the problem is that with the Kickstarters is that you often get such good deals in the Kickstarter that there's no reason for a store to carry that line, because anybody that was interested in it probably Kickstarted it. And then if you don't have store support, and you don't have, you know, you're not likely to have a store pushing it or whatever. So
no, exactly. And a lot of times you've both like tapped out a lot of your audience. If I bought 3 starter sets, I'm probably gonna go like a year before I buy new stuff at all. Plus this is a big problem on the RPG side as well, where you get games that get Kickstarted just are invisible in stores, you know. Not always, like, but you have to find a distributor or stuff. But so you get a lot of, like, I was musing on the fact that, like, whoever is in charge of, like, making the White Wolf stuff now, they've churned out, like, a whole bunch of different books, and they don't show up in stores at all, because most of them are being Kickstarted or crowdfunded directly to the fans, which is great for the fans, because you get books you wouldn't normally, but it's horrible for anyone trying to get into these games. You know, like, how are you going to get into a game that you don't even know exists? You know,
yeah, and there's no incentive for the store to carry it, so then the community's not supported, therefore doesn't really get played,
right? So what the store is going to carry then is Dungeons and Dragons and Warhammer 40k. I hope you like playing those two. You know, because that's what
BattleTech.
Yeah, well, BattleTech does carry like
BattleTech's kind of a phenomenon in Kickstarter. Honestly, they get to be successful in Kickstarter and still sell products in stores. It's amazing.
Yeah, they've sort of like nailed it. I don't know if it's just like the community, because like I've never met a
person
who was not waiting for an excuse to buy more mechs anyway.
Like, I always do. I just keep buying more. Yeah.
Like anyone who's trying to sell people on the plate battles, like, will always tell you, you only need like 4 mechs, and they all of them own like 800.
Yeah.
Like 200 of which are just different versions of the fucking archer. So, but you know, more power to them. It's successful. Like my brother-in-law was just asking me the other day, we're at Barnes & Noble's, if you know, the new BattleTech was any good. I'm like, yeah, it's the same game. It's been for like 30 years.
Yep.
You know, the fans are happy with it. My phone battery is starting. This is kind of the timer to keep our conversation short, is how long my phone battery lasts, because that's what I'm recording on. So it's starting to look a little sad. So
okay.
Do you wanna Give us a short overview. You were sort of alluding to it before, that you're working on this sort of solo RPG open world project. So what kind of, because solo RPGing, there's a fair amount of like stuff out there, but it's all very kind of, you know, there's some that are like, you can roll around a map and like roll up some encounters. And there's some that are kind of like journaling solo games. But this sounds like it's a very different kind of thing with a lot more going on. So do you want to kind of give us a short version of what's what it is and what it's going to be?
Okay. So I have done a lot of research for solo RPGs, especially hex crawls, etc. And I've watched tons of playthroughs with Bandit's Keep and a ton of them. And I know people really like super highly granular, like roll 70 times per day just for nothing to happen. I know some people love that, but I don't. So what I've done is I have consolidated rolling in every possible way, and I use D100 charts. So for instance, the gist of this is that there's a map you can probably see in the background here is the Brutality map. It's existed since I first originally made the book, but it was not fleshed out in the way that this is. I've got every biome has the flora, the fauna, who lives there, what's the the exports, the imports, activities to do like mining or whatever, every biome. And what I liken this to is like an MMO. If you were playing an MMO solo as one player, or as a small group of friends, you know, you can go over here and mine this, and you can go over there and beat this monster or whatever. And that's basically it. So this game is so vast that there's no way that you're going to do everything. You kind of have to, it's almost too much. You have to pick a lane. You have to be like, okay, I'm going to do this. And in the beginning, you choose your end goal. So you can choose easy goals or hard goals. There's different ranges. Like, I want to make my own settlement from scratch. Okay, well, then now you have a direction to go in. And I found that to be really important, because otherwise, like, the complete world is open to you. I mean, it takes 30 days to cross the continent. I mean, it is a huge, huge map. The map is 5,000 by 5,000 pixels, I think. It's gigantic. But the cool thing is that, like, when you're, I watch these playthroughs of solo RPGs, especially hex crawls, and they go, did I find any water today? And I roll a six. On a six, I found some water and don't consume any. Did I find any food and roll a six? And they roll 17 times a day. And it's like, I'm screaming in my head listening to this, right? And then at the end, he's like, oh, I found a dragon. Is it angry? No. Where is it? Oh, it's flying in the sky. Does it want to attack me? No, it doesn't see me. And why did I roll for 10 minutes? Like why? So every day is one exploration chart roll in my game. And what I've done is consolidate a bunch of stuff. Let's say you go to an unnamed settlement that's not named on the map, right? I have a D100 chart of pre-made nameless settlements. Some of them are ruins and they're no longer lived in, but they already have their faction affiliation, if any, who they hate, like types of species or types of factions they hate. What's the economy like? What's the adjective disposition of the population? Like, miserable or whatever. That's just for narrative purposes. Then I also have their leader's name and their hatreds and their disposition. And then I've got any merchants that are in that town. There's six different types of merchants. They all have a name, a disposition, and a hatred, if any. And I've essentially wrapped, I just counted tonight, I think it was 13 rolls in one roll. So you roll the D100 and you've got 13 rolls right there. Like, you don't roll 13 times. Yeah. And so when you meet a random NPC that wants to join your party, you roll a D100 chart and it gives you their hatred, their personality, and all their keywords. That's a pre-made character. What's neat about this is that I want it to be as model agnostic as possible. So I don't ever tell you what species. This guy's name might be Jorgen. And if you know, one of you sees it as an orc and one of you sees it as a robot, doesn't matter, because that's his name. That's how he is in your head. Really doesn't matter. So it's the same principles of brutality. It also definitely has the flavor of brutality, but like, my combats are just three rounds. It's three rolls. Now, included in this book, Modiphius really wanted me to include the brutality skirmish rules in it, So it also has, if you want to get tactical and you have an encounter in the woods, you can legit get terrain out and play. The rules are included in it. So you can legit play it. I personally care more about the story. So I find getting terrain out and all of that messes with my flow. I would rather keep going. But this is not, I am hesitant to call it an RPG. That's why I call it an adventure game. Because an RPG is often, oh, I turn the corner and is anybody there? And it's a moment by moment sort of thing. But this is a bit more zoomed out. So you might take a quest from someone. Again, the D100 quests of different values, distances, what they'll do if you don't, win, whatever. It's all wrapped up. But if you have to go find someone, then you need to go to the location they said to, and they'll pay you this amount of money, and you have to pass a perception challenge. Well, all your party members that have any bonuses to perception, you get to add that, whoever's present. And it's three rolls, best 2 out of 3. And if you win it, there's a twist at the end, but the quest is over. You can go get paid. It's more about the long term. What is your career? What is your legacy in this game? Yeah. You know, you can join factions. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what it makes me think of is if you zoomed out from, like, you're sitting around a table playing an RPG session and you have a bunch of stuff that happens, but it doesn't go anywhere or it doesn't work or whatever. And you have one or two things that were the big things that happened or that worked. And that's kind of like what this is distilling out. Like, okay,
yes,
let's just focus on those. And a bunch of other shit probably happened, and you can come up with that if you want, but that's not like important in the game.
Yes. And of course, there are some moment-to-moment things, like there's barter checks if you want a better price on something or whatever. But by and large, it is really condensed down to, I wanted to make it as simple as possible because I expect people to play it alone with no dungeon master or anything like that. But we have... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's something I have harped on many times, that solo games need to be just a notch below in difficulty.
Yeah.
Or complexity, rather.
I was just getting ready to say that, yeah, complexity rather than difficulty, because this game can be pretty unforgiving, but it kind of has to be, because if you're playing solo, if it's too easy, then why am I sitting in my gaming shed alone rolling dice if it's not a challenge, right? There's no reason. Then you feel stupid, right? Like, that's when you feel stupid.
I also find that solo gamers tend to be... Occasionally, a little masochistic. Like, there's a lot of solo gamers who appreciate a game that is tough. So it's obviously you can dial that in. Are you gonna have ways of? So with any game that's like heavily random, heavily procedural, that's always the, on one hand, you know, everything is random and you just go through it, and on the other hand, some games will have story points or some sort of resource that you can influence what happens in a certain direction. So where do you kind of fall on that?
This particular game, your actions are, so you can make people hate you. You can make people love you. If your reputation is high enough in a town, you can take it over, make a persuasion challenge and take it over because you're so darn popular. You can take over through combat. You can siege a settlement or whatever. You can even economically buy out the leader and go, hey, I'll buy this. And there's mechanics for that. If you are that wealthy, you can just buy the settlement. And there are a lot of there's a lot of like moral dilemmas, that sort of thing, where some of the exploration tables will have something like, just tonight we ran into an aquatic that was in the desert and all desiccated and dried out. And he begged my player that was playing to bring him to the water, and he'd give us a random item and we get plus one reputation with that faction. And he decided, okay, I'm low on supply, but I'll go do it just to be nice because he felt bad for the guy. But previous to that, he left the guy cornered by a big monster because he was so low on supply. You needed to throw supply at the monster to distract it to free the guy. And he was so low on supply, he was almost starving. So he couldn't afford that, you know?
Is supply kind of like a currency then?
Supply is your general, like food, water, torches, just it's a general unit. And your five main characters eat one supply a day. Even if you're a robot, you're like grease and joints and stuff. It's just a catch-all. You know, it's because in a video game, your currency that you do activities with is your time, right? Mm-hmm. But when time is not a factor, you need some sort of currency to make your actions be valuable. And that supply, your hirelings are one gold a day, which is it's three times more expensive than a regular party member. But this is cool too. You can have one character all the way to as many as you feel like managing. The highest I've done is 6 in a party, but you could arguably do 20. And there's rules in it to automate people. If you want to take a couple missions and send these people out, you have to prepay them for how long they're gone, but they can complete missions on their own too. There's so much you can do. Fishing, mining, crafting, building a settlement, animal taming, joining factions, making your own faction. There's multiple like demons you can release and try to like bring Armageddon on the... There's so much to do. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, so it kind of is a tabletop game.
It is. And what we've found so much pleasure in is me and my buddy are currently, I'm in like 8 different campaigns right now because different people are playtesting it with me. But this one, we decided to just be jerks. Me and him are just thieves. We steal from everybody. And when we get caught, we get ran out of town. Then we just go to the next town and steal until we get caught again. And we're just being mean.
Yeah.
And what's funny is at one point we decided to split up, and I said, okay, well, we're going to meet up in 20 days and we'll see what happens. So he went his way. I went mine, and we're sitting next to each other and rolling dice and giggling and writing down what happened because the other guy's not supposed to know yet until we meet back.
Yeah.
And he comes back with a new party member and I come back with a pet. And it's like, it was so cool. But so my goal for this would be really cool is if people took like Discord or something and they made like an adventurers league and they said, listen, once a month we'll meet up on the 15th and you have to have played 30 in-game days and we'll meet back up and share stories and stuff like that. Because one of my favorite parts of RPGs is always when one player has information that everyone else doesn't and they have to relay that information. It feels very like in-game, you know?
Yeah.
I love when
it's made the world come alive. A little
yes. Bit. And then the person doesn't always tell it quite right. And there's like this personality to it. And mm-hmm. yeah. So anyway, I could talk forever about it, but it's cool because it's solo at its core, but it easily can be party members and things. So
social solo.
Well, and
yep.
And that fits very much in the whole like vibe of like adventure gaming that Modiphius is kind of pushing into.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is one thing I wanted to ask you guys. Do you have any juicy shop mm-hmm. talk for Modiphius?
Oh, did you want to check?
I don't think that Chris Birch listens, honestly. You can say anything you want.
Well, I was going to send this to him afterwards. But unfortunately, the only really, I have like one and two and a half juicy things, but I, can't. So, and I'm like burning too because one of them is literally like a dream come true. But I can't say anything. Like the contract is done. I got like I'm working on it, but can't say nothing. So no like juicy shop talk. However, if we have you back at some point, I think it would be interesting to talk about the differences between writing on your own versus writing for publication through, because there's different factors and considerations that goes into, you know, this has to fit in a book, which means it has to be within certain lengths. It has to, you mm-hmm. know, there's just a whole bunch of different considerations that you have to account for where when you're doing it all yourself, or, you know, even if you hire an artist, but you're still like, you choose where everything goes. You choose how it all goes together. If it's 17 pages or 800, that's up to you.
Yeah.
That's not the case when it has to be. Nobody's publishing 17 page hardcovers. They don't want to publish 800 page books either. You know, so that might be a discussion for a different.
Yeah, time. I would.
But we are kind of burning it.
Oh, this has been a blast. I'd love to be on again sometime. So,
heck yeah.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So but, we would definitely love to have
I have,
but like I said,
I have nothing is, really to say about Chris. I mean, he's been nice enough to me, but we haven't, you know, I haven't actually published with him yet. So I'm right on the cusp of that because I'm about done with the project. But you know, mm-hmm. they've been very pleasant to me. So that's all I can really say because haven't really dealt with them. I haven't actually published with them yet, so I don't have that much to say.
Yeah. So, and it's the whole process to go through, like, the editing process and everything, like, all of that stuff. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yep.
All right. That is all the questions I have. Any last words from you, Dave?
Not for me. Sorry, my daughter was just asking me where something was. My phone was going off.
Did you know where it was?
No. She's looking for her blue portable Switch, and I have no idea. I don't have it. That's all I can tell you. I wasn't playing it. I did.
You weren't catching Pokemon on
the
slot.
So we're wrapping things up because it's about that time. Perfect. Did you have any last words, Scott?
Oh.
No, I'm just happy to be on. I enjoyed talking to you guys. So if you guys want me on again, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, definitely. We only do like twice a month and we're kind of booked up now. We'll be having Roby Jenkins in on as well, who, I mean, technically he is a published Modiphius author, who is not, because he wrote the rules for Hard War.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But we're looking good.
I think they like straight up like bought them off of him. I'm not sure. Actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll definitely have to schedule something in towards the end of summer.
Right? Maybe after, you get a little farther along with the book, we can touch base again.
Yeah, actually, that would be interesting too. Once it's sort of in that process, whereas, you know.
Yeah, I'm just about to send it to the editor soon. So, or the layout person. So,
yeah.
Juicy.
So I was, I'm sweating bullets when I opened that like email with like 2,000 comments. In it. are you sure this is English? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what people said when I grew up on TV. So I'm pretty sure that. All right. Well, I guess that is basically it.
Okay. So our tradition is to
hang out.
Say goodbye to everyone with little hearts. We like to give our audience big hearts. And
sometimes
it heart attacks.
Little animated hearts, but it doesn't.
Not this time. Not anymore. Yeah. Magic's gone, unfortunately.
The real hearts were the hearts we made along the way.
That's right. Okay, folks. Everyone, take care. Right. Bye.
Have a nice night.
Have a good night, people. Bye.
This episode of Bad Internet Friends was streamed live on YouTube and Twitch. There is a North American-friendly live stream every second Wednesday of the month and a European-friendly live stream every fourth Monday of the month.